Now, is he playing games? Is he just playing hard to get? No. But that's the problem. If you have children, I'm sure you recognize this pattern. You want them to think. You want them to remember. You want them to apply. And God is the perfect father. And often the wisdom I don't receive is because he's already told me. He says, son, do what I already told you. And of course, what happens when I do that? Then, pretty soon I don't need any more wisdom because I do that thing and I realize it's a sequence of things. I obey on this, and then the next thing comes and I realize, oh, wow, they all fit together. See, we want to skip the parts that we don't like, but it just doesn't work that way. Any of you guys put stuff together without the instructions and then find lots of nuts and bolts left over at the end? Then you have to go back, take it all apart, retrace your steps, and this time do it with the instructions. Now, probably none of you do that. I know Jimmy doesn't do that because he's Mr. Focus. But no, we pretty much all do that, don't we? So, those are reasons why God gives wisdom. And we don't receive it. Sometimes we don't have the wisdom simply because we haven't asked God. We've asked everybody else, but we haven't asked him. Sometimes we don't have wisdom from him because we haven't made up our mind that we're going to do what he says. Sometimes he's already told us he just wants us to take the stuff we know on this subject over here and apply it to this subject over here. That, my friends, is what creates stability. That's what creates a person who's unflappable. I really want to be that. I have danced a great portion of my life trying to avoid the lessons I didn't want to learn. But God's just too good of a father. He's not going to let me do that. And I keep running into the same things. And I discover that when I allow him to finish the work of perseverance, when I do what he says, when I do it step by step, day by day, lo and behold, my life changes. I change. So, in the context of believers, now we get to the part we're going to look at tonight. Verses 9, 10, and 11, and 12. I'm reading from the NIV. I know that I've read the New King James. It is worded a little bit different. I don't think I'll leave anything out that's important, even reading from this. The brother in humble circumstances, or the brother in a lowly position, some translations say, ought to take pride in his high position. But the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like a wildflower. And James waxes eloquent on this subject, which to our Gentile brains living in this country, we may miss the whole point. The sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant, and its blossom fails and its beauty is destroyed. And in the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. Happy, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has passed the test or been approved or stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. That's the portion we will look at the rest of our time. Hasn't this been a wonderful year for wildflowers? I can't remember in Maine, since I've lived here 13 years, I can't remember them lasting so long. It's just been really cool. They started early and they're lasting long. When my sister and her husband were out here in March, was it March? Might have been May or April. Anyway, it was already brown and everything was dead out there in Northern California. In Israel, certain time of the year, which is why we go in March, because if you go earlier, it's the mud season, there's a certain time when all the hills turn green, there's wildflowers, and that can last 7 or 8 days. that could last 2 weeks. There are record years when the wildflowers were out for about 24 hours. And then, poof, they're gone. And you can see why Jesus used that example and Solomon used that example. And now James is using that example to illustrate uncertainty. James is using it here regarding wealth. What James is saying, in a nutshell, to believers regarding trials, if you do not have the ability to answer your own needs, answer your own prayers, get yourself out of this trial, you're barely sucking ditch water in your life, that's okay. That's not going to stop God from taking care of you, because you're a child of God and his resources aren't limited like yours. If you're a rich person and you don't even have to think about needs because you can pretty much do what you want, he says, keep in mind, that can be gone in an instant. You could be humbled. All of this feeling of power and destiny and self-control, the captain of your fate, blah, 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 all that stuff that having more than enough makes people feel. He said, that could all change. What James is saying is akin to humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and he'll lift you up. So the rich believer and the poor believer meet on the same ground. I want to talk about this for all. I'm going to give you the definition of those words, by the way. I looked them up. They're colorful. The brother in humble circumstances, verse 9 says, the lowly position. Some translations just use the word poor. And that's legitimate translation of the Greek word, tapenos. Here's what it means. My Greek dictionary said it means literally, when it's not used just as a metaphor, just translated, it means not rising far off the ground. Isn't that a great word? You know, you are on your lips. You try to lift your head. You can't lift your head very far off the ground. That's pretty much your life. Second ditch water is what, in my neighborhood, we used to call it. Having barely enough is another way. So what does rich mean? This is hard to talk to Americans about, because if we use an American standard to discover whether we're rich or not, you're going to know, but I know rich people that don't think they're rich. If it depends on who you're comparing yourself to. But if you compare yourself to about 97% of the world population, a lower middle class American is rich by comparison. But here's an interesting thing. Here's what the word means. And all of its derivatives, riches, wealth. The Greek word is the word plousios. Plousios. These are some of the things the commentary wrote about plousios. Here's what it means. It means more than enough, which is what abundant means. It simply means more than you need. Plenty or wealthy. Flip over, if you will, all you former Baptists are going to love this kind of Bible study, because we're not just in one spot. We're going to flip over somewhere else. 1 Timothy chapter 6. I always write it in the margins of all my Bibles, and that this passage in James. I write 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 19. Let me read it to you. Timothy, a pastor, Paul writing to his protege about believers. Listen to what he says. Command, not suggest, not advise, command those who are rich in this present world. What does rich mean? Same word, plousios. It means who have more than enough. So that could be you. That could be me at any given point in our lives. Command those who are rich in this present world three things. Not to be arrogant. Not to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. Why would God say that, do you think? Why would he tell me not to put my future hope in wealth? because he doesn't want me to be secure. No, exactly the opposite. He wants me to be secure, and it can come, it comes and it goes. So don't put your hope in wealth, but do put your hope in God. And I love this phrase, God who richly and ceaselessly, the Amplified Bible says, provides us with everything for our enjoyment. James is going to say later, a few months, we'll be studying James saying, every good gift, every perfect gift. Don't let anybody mislead you. Every good and perfect gift comes from your Father in heaven. Paul's writing the same thing. Put your hope in God who richly, ceaselessly provides us with everything. Now he gives a couple of other commands. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. And in this way, they'll lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they can take hold of the life that is truly life. That is a wonderful companion to these few verses in James. And I do want to talk about it for a minute. To not put their hope in riches. Once again, in having more than enough. You know that feeling. I've got so many illustrations of this because God's run me through this so many times. I've scraped and scraped and scraped and scraped till I could get enough money. I've worked hard to get debt-free, except for my house, which technically is supposed to be worth more than I owe on it, so that's not a debt. And I scrape a little bit together, and all of a sudden an unforeseen trial comes and just sucks that away, and I'm discouraged. Many times I've had this conversation. I've been sitting there looking at that empty checking account thinking, man, I had to spend all that money. And the Lord will say something like, what if you didn't have that money? Then you'd be up a creek, wouldn't you? Well, yeah, but I didn't want to spend it. I wanted to have it. Because when I have it, I'm safe. Bogus. That's the way we think. Let me tell you, who is that trusting in? Yeah, is that trusting in God? Well, we would never admit it, but that's a false God, isn't it? Oh, but I had all that money. I had other stuff that I was going to do with it. Yeah, but you didn't know this thing over here was going to happen, did you? No, I didn't, but God did. So I'm feeling ripped off when I just got provided for. Is that silly? I'm ripped off because I wanted to have that money. When I was in college, I had a roommate. I won't tell you his name. I doubt very much that he's going to be listening to my Bible study, but just to protect the innocent. Right when he started college, his dad was a minister who had another part-time job, working two jobs to take care of his family, barely had the money to send his kid to college. His dad had gone in with his brother and bought 20,000 acres of desert land outside of Palmdale, California, for $5 an acre. They mortgaged both of their houses and got a loan, bought 20,000 acres at $5 an acre. So what's that, 100 grand plus interest? 2 years after they bought it, a consortium of enterprises decided to buy the land and build an airport. So they bought those 20,000 acres at $7,500 an acre. And my roommate's dad all of a sudden was a multi-millionaire. He bought a $5 million yacht as a tax write-off. Never set foot on it. It was in another country, as a matter of fact. So because he grew up poor, he said, my kids are not going to have to live the way I lived. So they could have anything they wanted. And it ruined them. My roommate could have any car that he wanted. And of course, when you can have any car that you want, you don't take care of them. I remember the first car I bought, I parked it miles away from other cars in the parking lot, lest anyone ding the door. You know, he wrecked his Ferrari. Big deal. He had another one in about 3 days. He just didn't appreciate anything that he had. Now, you might think, well, I'd like to try that out for a while. But it destroyed them. It didn't solve any problems for them. I think by anyone's definition, that would be more than enough. But I know he didn't trust any of his friends because he didn't know if they were really friends. He didn't trust any girls that he dated because he didn't know if they were dating him because they liked him or because he had $50 million. And his life was miserable. And I'm not exaggerating. This is the truth. So by itself, because you know how we are, we think if I just had more money, I'd be okay. Maybe not. So what Paul wrote to Timothy was, if you have that pile of loot, don't lean on it. It could be gone like that. The whole deal with financial security, isn't it funny? Despite what's happened in front of our very eyeballs, some people have lost everything. They'll never be able to recover what they've lost because of one misappropriation of funds by one executive in speculative banking. And this isn't just risky millionaires. This is mom and pops who have their retirement fund and their savings, you know, in a mutual fund or a bank that was affected by this. And we still think there's such a thing as financial security when the Bible says, don't go there. Trust in God. You don't need that. You have something, a resource that cannot ever be tapped out. Masterfully and perfectly managed by the greatest mind in the universe who loves you like your favorite child. So James says to the brother in low circumstances, hey, you got it made, baby. Your dad is the king of the universe. So rejoice in that. And you rich person, just be aware those beautiful wildflowers could be gone tomorrow when the scorching sun comes up. Just don't lean on it. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord. You're God's child too. You and the poor guy, you're standing in the same place. Don't place your hope, Paul wrote to Timothy, to tell the people who had more than enough. Don't place your hope. What does the word hope mean? Maybe I should give that in case. It means the confident expectation of future good. One of my favorite words. The verb is elpizo in Greek. Sort of sounds like a Mexican pizza. Elpis is the noun. The confident expectation of future good. In Corinthians, Paul says that it's one of the three pieces of standard equipment on every Christian life. Faith, hope, and love. Standard equipment. But isn't it interesting that Paul's commanding Timothy to command believers where to put their hope? So apparently it's not automatic that if you're a believer, you're going to put all your confident expectation of future good in God. Because most of the time, we don't. If we have enough or more than enough, we put our confident expectation of future good that I'll be able to guard that and hang on to it. And then eventually, then I'll be okay. I have it, so I'm safe. If we don't have enough, if we're sucking ditch water, we think if I just had that, that would be my confident expectation of future good. And you know what? It's just not true. I only know one place. I'm absolutely confident, regardless of what happens to my health or the U.S. economy or some unforeseen terrorist activity, regardless of anything that could come down the pike, I know one place I'm absolutely confident is going to be good in the future, and that is my Heavenly Father. and that's where to place your hope. And that's just wonderful, wonderful advice. God has this funny, cute little way of showing me that I really don't trust him. Well, because he knows. It's that thing of, I love how he reasons with me. It's that thing of, I was looking for, well, for years, for probably most of my life, most of my income came from royalty checks every quarter. Of course, I had no way of knowing how much it was going to be. If it was $10,000, the next quarter that I was hoping for $10,000, it would be $78. And I don't know if, you know, and he never let me get my rhythm with trusting in anything except him, which now I look at it, he was really doing me a favor, but it was hard to get used to, because that's not the way we think, is it? I want to know, how much am I going to have? What day am I going to have it? Because those bills, they're going to be there. Like God doesn't know. Oh, of course he knows.